This is Alicia Ruverall, and I'm with Julia Scatliff at her home in Durham, North Carolina. And this is March 26, 1996, and this is tape number 32696, JS.1. And we're talking about women's leadership. This is part of the Women's Leadership and Grassroots Activism Project for the Southern Oral History Program. Okay, so we can just... I'll sign off on that afterwards.
Okay.
Great. Good. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about how the organization, how the Southern Community Partners came about, and, you know, your role in that. How did it all begin?
I was both on the staff and director of the Campus Outreach Opportunity League, mm-hmm. and through that had a chance to get to know one of our funders, Jack Murrah, mm-hmm. who runs the Lyndhurst Foundation, and along with a couple of other colleagues and friends, started to kick around the idea of a fellowship program that would support people who really built strong leadership skills and experience in college, but once they graduated, they didn't know how to turn it into, I guess, what they thought was a career, or that they had financial means to live out the dreams that they had. It took a long time for that kernel of an idea to become a program. Mm-hmm. We started talking about Southern Community Partners in 1987, mm-hmm. and in the spring of 1991, it became a reality.
So, wow.
4 years later. I mean, I guess that's not too long, but in
the gestation period.
Seemed like a long time at the time. We've been up and running for 4.5 years and have funded 26 people, all who have their own dreams. So, in a sense, it's a brokering of people's hopes into the programs that they know they can create. They just need the support to do so.
Great. Wow. Well, can you backtrack a little bit and talk more about your role in COOL and sort of how and why you were led to that work?
I was led to COOL by the founder of the organization, a guy named Wayne Meisel, who was from Minnesota originally and came to Carleton College, where I was then a senior, He had used the technique that we then used on so many campuses of going to the college president, asking him if there was a way to free up some monies to create a base for community service on that campus. I desperately wanted to be the assistant to the president at Carleton. I don't really know why, but I just thought it'd be a great way to have a prestigious position and make absolutely no decisions. And that was my dream. So I spent most of my senior year walking a mile to class every day, basically preparing an interview that I would have with the president. And it was just a happy circumstance that it was sort of a convergence of a president who really wanted something to happen, Wayne Meisel, who had started COOL and wanted to see our campus create something, and I had had this lifetime of experience in community service, but hadn't really been all that involved as a college student. But at the same time, had taken my freshman civics course from Paul Wellstone, now senator from Minnesota, was a professor at Carleton at the time, and had done small things that made me know that there were desperate situations on the farms around Carleton with farm foreclosures, and I lived right next door to a senior center and got a chance to get to know people individually. So I can't say that my activism per se came out of any personal trauma or trauma of a societal proportions. But I think that's really why students have turned more and more to community involvement on an individual basis, because there have not been the same crises that people a generation older than ours have experienced.
Yeah, that the book that was mentioned in the article that you'd sent, Crossroads.
Generation at the Crossroads.
I think it's really, I was really struck by that whole notion, and in some ways I could see some parallels with our project where you try and sort of separate what's the myth about, you know, activism and what's going on in the 90s, you know, that like nobody's active anymore or whatever, and then when you actually talk to people, there's actually wonderful projects that are going on, and I was really struck by that with, you know, what he tried to do was, it looked like, you know, tried to gather stories that were examples of ways in which people are contributing, you know, and taking action, even though there's this perception that youth today is cynical and unengaged and so forth, or disengaged.
Well, I think there's a real effort to build community through very large events, somewhat in the way of the late 60s, early 70s, with the Million Man March and Stand for Children that Children's Defense Fund will do June 1st. And I think those types of pivotal moments are helpful for all of us because there just haven't been that many of them. But that hasn't stopped individuals from doing work right at hand. And that was really the impetus for COOL to try and collect all of these people and to really push higher education to put money into structures on campus. Because if you can't see it, you're less likely to do the work. Or if you feel like you won't be rewarded for it. In the same way you would if there's a really great science lab on campus and a huge building. If there isn't a similar place where people who care deeply about the community around them can meet and talk, then it's not going to happen.
Right, yeah. Well, now with Southern Community Partners, it seems as though the goal is around empowering leadership among young people. Can you talk a little bit about your goals with that and whether it's been a successful process? Has it, you know, met your expectations?
Well, there. I don't think everyone has had a successful 2 years. Project-wise, I would venture to say that everyone who has been involved with Southern Community Partners and their work has grown immensely from the work that they endeavor. Our primary definition of leadership is that you take on the responsibility of getting other people involved in the work that you believe in, and that you come from a place where your passion is so deeply within you that you don't lose sight throughout the time. What do I mean by that? That if you are starting a single parent network, that you are a single parent, so you're living day to day with the issues that you're trying to build with your constituency. That if you're running a student with disabilities volunteer project, as one partner is, that you understand firsthand what that means. Now, what happens sometimes is that the passion can't be so close that you lose any perspective on a path, and that's been the struggle with every single partner. That balance of, because some people aren't operating out of their own personal experience, they're operating out of belief that they can make a difference.
So it sounds as though, you want to have enough community connection that it's a project that's not being sort of foisted upon a community, but on the other hand, if someone's too far inside, can they get caught in sort of the insider perspective and not able to look at it broadly enough?
Or some people are so close to the experience that they're working within that they have a hard time reaching out to other people. They feel they know best what must happen. Our first year of funding, we had half maybe successful and the other half really not successful at all. And I think we didn't quite understand that balance between funding individuals and funding people who bring institutions along with them.
Hmm.
And that's a key step for successful mm-hmm. programs. People who know how to build partnerships with others mm-hmm. know that they're getting a check, but that check is meant to make work happen
mm-hmm.
For a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Boy, I could see where it could be challenging for some younger people who are maybe not accustomed to being that self-directed in a way, you know? I mean, that's something I think you mature into.
Totally.
I don't think I could have dealt with it, let's just say that.
I think that you really have focused in on one of the biggest challenges. You know, mm-hmm. how do you get out of bed every morning if no one mm-hmm. cares if you're mm-hmm. reporting to work? Some people wow. work out of their home. I don't encourage it, but mm-hmm. some people do. And mm-hmm. so that those challenges of discipline are so key. I think another thing that is a real leadership challenge for all partners and for myself is mm-hmm. many people come into this work not really understanding what a persona is and how people see them out mm. in public, and that has brought great trouble.
That's really interesting.
How yeah. they dress, right. how they talk to someone, how they balance being a friend and being a boss, and
right.
and what does it mean to be a boss or to be a friend, and
yeah.
you know, all of those things. They're learning as they go, and I'm learning too. I have really learned a lot about my persona through this work. How to be kind, but off enough in the distance to really have perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things you have learned through that process, through witnessing what they have stumbled over and done?
Oh my goodness. One thing that we do now that we didn't do at first is I've always demanded quarterly reports from partners, because mm-hmm. what else do you have to gauge what people are doing,
mm-hmm.
And they don't get their money until the quarterly report comes in,
oh.
and so there's that kind of accountability
mm-hmm.
that's key. I used to just basically accept crap, you know. Sometimes I would accept reports that just were terrible, and I thought, well, this is self-expression.
Wow.
Well, now it's almost turned into a publishing house every quarter. You know, we demand
wow.
that
yeah.
everything's perfect, and
mm-hmm.
that we understand fully what they're explaining to us.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's a snow job and that they don't explain some of the challenges, but
mm-hmm.
that we learn from their documents.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you were to look at, say, the first collection of quarterly reports, well,
mm-hmm.
when we first started, we didn't share quarterly reports, and that was...
You mean among... among the
partners.
Yeah.
So I learned a ton. I mean, this is just management 101, but... You know, peers learn a lot from each other,
mm-hmm.
and they learn, they want to do better if they know it's going to be shown.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a great way
mm-hmm.
to clear up some of the junk. But just each time people, because they knew this time would come each quarter,
mm-hmm.
keeping a better journal along the way so they could really think about what
mm-hmm.
they're doing. So they could look back on their quarter and have some assurance that they would remember.
Mm-hmm.
some
mm-hmm.
of their challenges.
Mm-hmm.
We have a whole section that I ask of people in the quarterly reports called Lessons Learned, and
that's
a
good.
Real persona builder. I mean,
mm-hmm.
people are really working things out as they go. We have a woman in Jackson, Mississippi, Leanna Varga, who has had a hell of a winter. She is running the Jackson Servant Leadership Corps, and the whole idea around that is that you do service. They got AmeriCorps money to fund the 5 people in the Corps.
Mm-hmm.
They all live in a house together, and the point is to build and reflect and understand their spiritual growth as they volunteer. Well, it's every residential program I've ever witnessed has been pretty hellish, because it's hard to live with people, period. Let alone intentionally.
Right.
You didn't choose who you were going to be with. Well, 2 weeks ago, one of the core members was fired because he wasn't showing up. Well, the board members were upset because 2 of the board members had fallen for each other and were now, like, spending every night together.
Wow.
And, gosh, why didn't we think that we have
this
to have these rules
happen,
and whatever?
Yeah.
So they resigned. So now they're two core members in the huge house, and she's just trying to put the pieces back together again.
Yeah.
But that stuff is great. I mean, to have those...
It's part of the experience, in a way, for them. For you, I guess.
Every quarter for the past year, I've written a letter where I've talked to them about how I feel about certain matters. And usually it's drawn from working with them. And I mean, this whole issue around... There's such a pious relationship between your funder and your work that you feel as if you can't tell the truth.
Yes, I recall that from writing grant reports.
Right. I do too.
Right.
And so I keep trying really hard to break some of that down. And I try very hard that it then won't hurt them if I do know that about them.
Yeah. So, well, it sounds like it's been a time of real learning for all involved. I mean,
Definitely. Clearly
it's got to be profoundly altering for the students, really, or I guess young people, I really should be saying, since most of them are finished with school. But for them to be in a position where they're having their dreams supported, you know, and the responsibility that comes with that, and then on your end or the institution's end, wanting to support that, but at the same time having to be accountable, or, you know, requiring
exactly.
that they be accountable. You don't want to squash their dreams on one hand, but at the same time, there's a project that needs to be conducted and reports to actual lenders.
You
and,
figured it out. That's absolutely right. That's the tension.
Wow.
That's definitely the
tension. Yet, at the same time, if young people aren't given the opportunity, I mean, which was, wasn't that your initial goal, was that they would be...
Yeah, there's a woman who I've been... I talked to her on the telephone a couple of times, and she wanted to apply to be a partner. She's 34 years old, and she was really upset when I told her that we primarily fund people in their 20s. Actually, my rule is they have to be younger than me. I'm 32, so they have to be just a little bit younger than me. I said, well, look, you can submit your proposal. I doubt that we're going to be able to fund you because the project itself didn't fit the criteria of getting a lot of other people involved in service. She got really angry with me through this whole discussion, and her latest email to me said, you know, I'm 34 and I have a ton of experience, and I don't understand why I couldn't... Oh, she was worried that, like, I would get $18,000 a year for a full-time work. I mean, how could that even be fair? And she said, I should be able to get this for quarter-time work because I have more experience than they do, you know, four-time, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an interesting argument, but, you know, I don't buy it. I think, I mean, we're funding people who, because of where they are in life, they have a flexibility that's really enviable, and one that I think sparks work that people of no other generation can do. I couldn't do it at this point in my life.
What do these young partners bring that someone, say, this woman who's 34, wouldn't bring, for instance? What makes their age and experience kind of unique to what that opportunity can be, do you think?
Well, I think she would bring a lot to the project. So I don't mean to discount what she would bring. What would a person who's 24 years old bring? I think you know less of what works and doesn't work, and so there's, you just don't have as many assumptions. And sometimes I look at it and go, oh my God, you're going to fall on your butt, you know, but like this morning I talked to this woman, Leanne, who runs the, she's works with disabled students as volunteers, and she is planning what she's going to do July 1st when we can't fund her anymore, and her primary funding idea is a bowl-a-thon, and it's going to happen in a couple of months, and she's claiming that at the bowl-a-thon they're going to raise $15,000, and that's going to support her base salary. This is in one night with some sponsorship of businesses and such. Well, I look at it and go, you're crazy. But I also think, you know, if she was 34, she would not be planning bowl-a-thons for her salary. But, you know, maybe she will raise that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you have to almost give people the opportunity to goof up for themselves. That's part
right.
of the learning is.
And they might not. And then what do you, you know, then mm-hmm. you have to eat. Mm-hmm. Eat your words.
Wow. Yeah, pretty wild.
Or just all the crazy hours, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that other activists that you've talked to of all generations work crazy hours. Mm-hmm. But there's some really, really crazy, intense work mm-hmm. that people do when they have made fewer commitments for themselves in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they can channel all that energy.
They do. And that can also cause major problems because then they're trying to take out of their work everything they need. Mm-hmm. And that can...
Right. I was struck in the application about that question that said, how will you schedule time for yourself, for friends, for mm-hmm. a movie? I thought, why doesn't anyone ask that on a grant application?
I know.
This is like, I stopped at that and I went, oh boy, that one would really, like, you know, be a stumbling block, because so much of activism, leadership, community building, that kind of work, seems to have burnout, like, mm-hmm. profoundly etched into its definition.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. And I... It was funny. 2 weeks ago, I got messages in the same afternoon from... And thank God for voicemail. Like, partners will call me at, like, 3 in the morning and just talk for the 5 minutes about everything that's happening. And it's kind of fun because they don't want to talk to me, really, but they want me to know what's going on. But in one afternoon... Two partners, Leanna, who now had this core of 2 out of 5 left, she was headed for the beach for a week to try mm-hmm. and recover. And then another partner from Birmingham, Alabama, who builds buildings out of dirt bricks,
right.
Frank Dominic, called and said, well, I'm never guess where I am. I'm at the beach trying to recover from, you know, so there's this sort of tanked recovery that I hope that through the program they can learn how to balance it a little bit more mm-hmm. instead of crashing and then trying to get better and then go
right.
back.
Sort of the crash and burn approach, yeah.
But at the same time, there is this kind of energy, like Jason Moss in New Orleans, who mm-hmm. runs New Orleans Outreach, and they had an evening with the Saints, a night where they were going to bring... New Orleans Saints professional football players for a fundraiser. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, like 5 or 6 days before it, they had sold like 40 tickets or something. But, you know, then the night of, they had 300 people there. I mean, it's that kind of...
Wow.
I can put everything aside and make something happen uh-huh. That's the tenor of the kind uh-huh. of people that we work with.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What about with some of the earlier partners? Have you had a chance to see what life is like for them after that two-year sort of intensive period?
There have been two classes that have moved on. The first class, two of the seven have carried on in the spirit of the work that they began, but in other places they're organizing for the Industrial Areas Foundation.
Hmm.
But they... left very strong organizations, the West Virginia Organizing Project, that's doing wonderful stuff, and the West End Community Center here in Durham, same thing. Another woman was working in Mississippi, and her work that she began in the public schools is still carrying on, not in the same way, but doing better. The other four, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing institutionally.
Right.
This past year, I think we really got petrified after the first class. We thought, you know, is this, are we doing this right? And, you know, great people, but are we getting the people who can really make the most out of this experience? And up until, to this very day, 7 out of 7 are still running their programs.
Wow, that's really impressive.
Everything's funded. They're doing great work. Now, 2 of the 7 will be gone within the month, but
yeah.
they've got their hiring replacements.
Yeah.
They've got funding for their programs. The woman, Rhonda, who runs the Single Parent Network,
mm-hmm.
not only has another director in place, but they have a CD coming out that's going to, to have incredible musicians from the Appalachian area and drumming and all sorts of stuff. And now that will raise money for their organization.
Yeah. What would be one example that you would point to as sort of particularly successful and why of some of the partners' work?
Well, I think the work that Jason Scott has done in this area is really phenomenal. I don't know if you've...
Is he with...
He started North Carolina Public Allies. He represents the kind of partner who decides to stay within an organization but create it somewhere else. Or, you know, Public Allies existed up in D.C. and he wanted to take... Are you familiar with it at all?
I don't think that I am, actually. I'm trying to place it.
Public Allies places people ages 18 to 30 in paid internships in nonprofit organizations wherever they are. And one out of the 5 days on Mondays they meet to reflect and gain better insight about what they're doing. I think the reason why Jason has been so successful, number one, he's got incredible funding sources carved out for himself, so when he leaves April 23rd or whatever, we'll be sad to see him leave, but it will carry on beautifully. And he's created this channel where this year there were maybe 6 Public Allies who applied to be partners.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's great.
And there are two of our finalists, 2 out of the 16, are Public Allies.
No
so
kidding.
It's this great kind of channel he's created.
Yeah.
So that I worked with a couple people to do a study for the Babcock Foundation on youth leadership. And the biggest thing out of that was if you want to support young people, you can't have just one program. You need programs that are in sequence that, or if it's not programs, that you have that mentor, that person who says, okay, you're great doing this. Why don't you try this? You know, just keep raising up. The standard as people go.
So that someone, a young person, can have sort of a succession of experiences.
Michelle Johnson in Nashville is doing great stuff too. She'll be finishing up with our funding June 30th, but it's really no problem. She's running the ABC program, Action on Behalf of Children. She's a lawyer, and she has created a whole network of lawyers all around the country who are coming to spend the summer in Nashville to work with kids who have health or educational disabilities. And it's just this incredible network of law students and lawyers and more senior lawyers who are all doing work that it just wouldn't happen without them. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And Michelle has really harnessed that kind of passion for this. Now, the great thing about what she's done is her funding will be up with us June 30th, but she's got a NAPL grant, National Association of Public Interest Law, and they're going to pay her salary for the next 2 years.
Wow.
So she's already... Now, that's in contrast to the bowling ball. I would love to see Leanne have something like that.
Now, was she... I seem to remember when I read about Michelle, did she already have a law degree when she started the program?
She did.
So that she may already have been in some of these networks, or at least starting to be in a place where she could link up with those kinds of associations.
She did. She was also a very petrified woman when she first got started. She, her interview has become kind of part of the lore of the program. Whenever we do interviews for our finalist weekends, we always have a hard pitch and soft pitch interview team, just so that if you don't do well in a hard pitch situation, you can shine when someone's just sort of sitting around asking questions like you are to me. Some people do better when they just are really... Well, she was in the hard pitch group, and she walked in the room, and they said, sit at the end of the table. It was this hugely long table, 16 feet, and they were all at one end, and she walked, without questioning, all the way to the other end, and then she sat down, and they said, oh, we're just kidding. She's so flustered. Know if that happened to her today, it's not as if we gave her anything. She just has realized her power as a person. She's really, another thing that upset me about her and her leadership style is that sometimes I think advocates can be really patronizing and, you know, action on behalf of children. I don't like the B in the title, but that's, you know, that's her choice. But she's really learned more and more about exchange between the people who she works with or serves, as some would say. She's getting married April 20th, and that's another reason why my social life is sort of odd. I go to these things, you know.
That's great.
There's a woman she's been working with for the past 2 years who has a son named Joey who's been, you know, on life support, all sorts of things. And she, the woman has a beautiful voice. And so, of course, the woman's going to sing in her wedding. You know, they've built their relationship into a friendship over a client only relationship.
So it seems like all sorts of connections come for these partners through this process of how their community widens and grows.
And the ones who are successful are the ones who take those connections and nurture them and build them and move off the island that they might have felt on when they first applied.
That's a nice example of the Michelle kind of sitting at the other end of the table, you know, sort of the power structure there. You're talking about her kind of realizing her power. How does that fit into what your organization is about? What is power and empowering? How does that fit into the equation for these partners?
Well, a lot of it has come in my role with them and then their role among peers. The relationship partners had at first was actually acrimonious, very competitive.
Amongst one another?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I think primarily because we didn't have our act together. We didn't know what our expectations were. And when leaders are that way, followers or people who are subjected to that take it out on each other. And
Interesting, yeah.
It happens. So I think they have gained power from each other because I think in large part, well, I used to feel I was the hub and they were the spokes and that was the wheel. And now I'm just one of the spokes in what they learn, but not the hub. The hub is some collective of all of us. And it's a relief. We are very heavily into using America Online to communicate with one another.
Right.
That has made a huge difference. So, you know, power is about knowledge and what you can share and in the best sense of the word. So now that they share with each other, the responsibility isn't so much on me. Now, I would say that I do play a very heavy hand in working with them in understanding their own power. Pushing them to use it.
What are the types of things that you tell them or try to reinforce?
I think the biggest thing that anyone can do for another person is to remind them of what they had intended to do. It's not so much what I share with them, but just picking out pieces of their application and reading it to them and do you remember what you wanted to do? Because when life is hard, it's that you've lost touch with what your core is, what you know you were brought to the earth to do, if you feel that way.
Yeah, so in a way it sounds like you kind of put them back in touch with or contact with what their goals were from the onset. Kind of what their inspiration was.
Well, and that's where personal crises are tough. Much more over if I had a 9-to-5 job and I was expected to do certain things at certain times. Aaron Melinda, who works in the mountains, has gone through incredible life-changing experiences since she was a partner. Her father dying, her grandfather dying, her deciding that she's going to divorce her husband, and then deciding, well, maybe she won't. And, you know, how do you, if there isn't that person in your life every day to remind you that you have dreams and visions that
right,
are part and parcel with all these other responsibilities in your life and your three children, and
it's a lot to juggle all at once. Yeah,
that's what I have felt is my job at its best. Now, with some people, I have not done a very good job, and part of it is because I can't click with them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get through to them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tap into their passion and support it.
Mm-hmm.
With others, no problem at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there others in the organization that can provide some of that support? Or I realize we could probably stand to kind of cycle back a little more to the organization itself. I mean, how many people are on staff, and sort of what's the configuration? I'm not sure how much of this is documented elsewhere, but from what I saw, it occurred to me maybe it wasn't.
Here's a
chance to do
sure.
it. You know?
There are two full-time people on staff.
Mm-hmm.
There are more at the Lyndhurst Foundation, but they don't operate, so the community partners. There are also 6 advisors. I'm included in that, so 5 advisors who basically select partners. Some develop a stronger relationship with a few of the partners. One advisor is an attorney, and so she knows Michelle better, but that's about it. So the day-to-day work of the partners is done by 2 people.
Wow.
I want it that way because I think,
yeah.
God, you know, I hate these organizations that have 14 staff people for 11 participants, you know, and they exist. They really exist. But at the same time, we take our work so seriously and our relationships are so deep that when 7 partners who you thought were going to kind of go off and maybe go to graduate school again, and then they stay on and they still want to talk and work with you.
Right.
That makes 19 people who you have a relationship with. Is it like a day-to-day staff person relationship? No. But it's hard sometimes for me to get my priorities straight, because I could be on the phone all day long talking to people or listening to people primarily about their challenges. And then there's other kind of creative projects that are harder to kickstart, so it might be easier to talk on the phone all day long with partners.
Right, that they kind of need that support.
They need it, and I'm happy to give it. And I mean, the hardest thing about that is that, you know, when you spend all day long listening to people and sharing their concerns, any friend or lover or family member, you can get in that same mode too, you know.
You're like, oh, I'll just talk to Julia. She's used to this.
Like an ex-boyfriend said to me, he said, I really feel badly for the next guy you're with when you're not running Southern Community Partners, because then they'll be like the energy of 26 partners on one man. But I'm sure it's not quite that way. But I mean, there is that kind of mode of work that both, I work with a woman named Lisa Roper, who came on board in July, and
sounds familiar to me. I'm not sure.
She used to work in Burlington. She's a program assistant, so she does do more office managerial work than I do, but we share it quite evenly, because she's got some great skills of just getting up. She got a web page up for us.
Oh, great.
And
good.
She's,
yeah.
you know, she's done some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
And she develops independent relationships with the partners in a way that's wonderful.
Neat.
And there's the work of the partners. There's other work. I mean, I keep up with a lot of people we turn down. Actually, some of my stronger relationships are with people we have turned down. Once we get beyond the awkward,
yeah,
frustrated stage.
Right, right, yeah. Well, could you talk a little bit about the founding process? I mean, it occurs to me, what one of the things we're trying to do is sort of document the steps that someone takes. And, you know, especially we're looking at women and how they choose to construct an institution and trying to understand more about why do they make those choices, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well,
I mean, literally, you had these ideas for 4 years and you were having these conversations, and what did you do with that? Sometimes those conversations don't go anywhere.
They usually don't.
Right.
Yeah. Well, my story is both, I think, energizing and also slightly a tale of woe. I didn't do a lot of the brokering for the program.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Meisel, who started Cool, did most of the brokering because he had the relationship with Jack Mura.
Mm-hmm.
I was more behind the scenes talking to him about what I thought would work, and then he and Jack would talk and meet. And I think primarily because I didn't have the confidence at that time to be in the room.
And how old were you at this time? What year would this have been?
Well, the conversation started when I was 20, 24, 25. And I came on as the director of the program when I was 28.
But now, with Cool, hadn't you been in a director role of some
sure.
capacity?
Sure.
Yeah, right.
And that was a problem, too. I mean,
I
really, my confidence as a leader has come almost exclusively, it has come almost exclusively through this, this work right now.
Wow.
As the director of Cool, I ran schools in the basement of my house all growing up. I ran summer camps. I mean, I ran all kinds of things where I was in a leadership position.
And were these predominantly there at the university, at Carleton College, or were you also, like, making trips?
What, the schools and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm talking about that was when I was 6 years old.
Oh.
I mean, I started really young with this stuff.
Wow, so wait, tell me again what you started when you were six? I was thinking, wait, was Cool organizing? I lost you there.
Easy.
So community organizing then started at six, so Cool was just an interim.
Yeah.
So what were you doing at age six that you were organizing?
I had neighborhood kids over, and I taught them lessons about nature and everything else, English. Yeah. So I ran schools from the time I was older than someone else. And then starting in maybe the sixth or seventh grade, ran summer camps in my backyard.
So these were sort of informally, just in the neighborhood, you would invite kids to
Yeah, and then kids who knew kids. And
yeah. What led you to do that at age six?
I have
lots
no
of
clue.
Kids are skipping rope. And
I don't know. I've always been overly into responsibility. So
wow.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it came. I mean, the camp thing came because I hated the Y camp. I was a counselor there. I was also a camper there, and it was at Camp Clearwater in Chapel Hill, and. I just hated how strict everything was and how guided by rules that I didn't think made sense, certain times to go to the bathroom. And so the one day that I actually wet my pants and just very much embarrassed myself, I said, forget this, you know, I can run my own camp. And I don't know if it happened that moment, but in hindsight, that's how it all fits.
Right.
So I guess all I'm saying is that I've created stuff all my life. I've never quite realized that I actually I could be given credit for it, or that I always kind of thought, I just didn't have any sense of my own power in situations, which caused a lot of problems when I was the director of Cool, because I wasn't a very good fundraiser as a result.
And what were you doing? Tell me in more specific detail about what you were doing at Cool and sort of how that then translated to Southern Community Partners.
Okay, I came on board in the summer of 86, and I ran a series of 9 workshops all around the country to get college students involved in community service. I'd never attended a conference before in my life. It was one of those jobs where you had no clue what you're doing, but you had to act like you did, and fine. So I did that for a year. And then we got money from the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation. Mm-hmm. And no one on the staff was from the South except for me. And so I got sent to work in the South. I worked on Duke's campus, mm-hmm. Bruce Payne's office that he wasn't using. And I just started traveling to campuses. And that's how we got the money from the Lyndhurst. We got mm-hmm. money from the Lyndhurst Foundation to do mm-hmm. more site visits on college campuses. Mm-hmm. And
So you really got exposed then kind of head on to young people and community service work.
Totally.
Just like,
yeah.
Wow.
All around the country and learned how to pack your bag in a minute, sleep on couches, mm-hmm. Just do very flexible work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we're getting close. I'm going to flip the tape quickly.
Okay.